This is Lance Lambert speaking, and this is my update for January 2012. It is amazing to me how quickly the years pass. It is already 2012, a year of crisis for Israel and the Middle East and the world in general. The last year, 2011, was a year of change. Earthquakes, tsunami, volcanoes, fire, tornadoes, hurricanes, floods. Some of them of enormous proportion. It was the year of the so-called Arab uprising and the whole quest for a new form of government in Arab lands. It was the year in which Kim Jong-il, the North Korean dictator, died. And that means so much for North Korea and for the poison it spreads in so much of the world. And then, of course, it was the year that Iran made her quest for nuclear devices even more obvious. What will 2012 hold? We do not know what this new year holds, but we do know the one who holds the year of 2012 in his hand. I would like to read the scriptures, and I'm going to read from Zechariah's prophecy and chapter 12 and from verse 1. It is a specific prophetic word about Israel. The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Thus saith the Lord, who stretcheth forth the heavens, and layeth the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of reeling unto all the peoples round about, and upon Judah also shall it be in the siege against Jerusalem. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the peoples. All that burden themselves with it shall be sore wounded, and all the nations of the earth shall be gathered together against it. And then, in the prophecy from verse 9, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, and they shall look unto me whom they have pierced. Chapter 13, verse 1. In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. To this I want to add another scripture in Lamentations and chapter 3 from verse 22. It is of the Lord's loving kindnesses, his chesed, his many expressions of chesed, that we are not consumed because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, saith my soul. Therefore will I hope in him. The Lord is good unto them that wait for him, to the soul that seeketh him, And then verse 31. For the Lord will not cast off forever, for though he cause grief, yet will he have compassion according to the multitude of his loving kindnesses. For he doth not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. In this update, I want to cover quite a bit of ground. I want to talk about the Amman talks, the talks in Amman between Fatah and Israel, under the auspices and chairmanship of King Abdullah II of Jordan. I want to talk about the peace process. Is it in deep freeze? Or is there any hope? I think of Psalm 33, verse 9 and 10. I also want to speak about the radicalization, the possible radicalization of the PLO. Then again, the Iran syndrome. Where is Iran at present, and what does it mean for Israel, for the Middle East, and for the world in general? I want to talk and cover the Arab Spring, so-called, as to whether it really was a spring, whether it's true democracy, exactly what it is leading for. Then I want to talk about Israel herself and the problems that Israel is facing domestically within herself, as well as the many other aspects of Israeli life at present, including the rainfall. And finally, I want to say something about Zechariah chapter 13 and verse 1. In that day, there shall be a fountain opened for sin and for uncleanness for the inhabitants of Jerusalem and for the house of David. Firstly, let me say something about the Amman talks. At present, the talks between Israel and the Palestinians in Amman, Jordan, under the chairmanship of King Abdullah II of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, don't seem to be getting anywhere. There is talk, of course, of them going on. The Palestinians have said that they will cut off talks on the 26th of January, just a few days, really, from now. Whereas Israel feels that the talks should go on, as originally planned, into the end of March and into the beginning of April. Will it get anywhere? That is the real question on these talks. The fact of the matter is that in spite of Netanyahu saying again and again there cannot be any preconditions for these talks, the PLO has insisted on a freeze in any form of construction within the settlements in Judea and Samaria and in Jerusalem, what they call East Jerusalem, which actually covers a much larger area than East Jerusalem. Israel, on the other hand, has wanted a definite response from the PLO that it recognizes Israel as a Jewish state, and a demand that the PLO feels unable to accept. That is just only one demand that Israel has made. There are others too. in the question of borders, that there should be a negotiation over borders. They do not believe that the 67 borders of Israel should still be kept today. It is not possible to defend Israel with those borders. After all, the border of this sovereign Palestinian state would be literally a few miles from Netanya. They could cut the country in two in a few moments. Then again, there is the possible radicalization of the PLO. What do I mean? I mean that they have talked about the possibility of Hamas and al-Jihad and other extremist terrorist organizations coming officially into the framework of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Israel has said very clearly that if those steps are taken and those extremist groups come in to the PLO, there can be no talks whatsoever. They will be dead from the beginning. The fact of the matter is, Hamas has within its actual constitution the proposed and determined plan to annihilate Israel totally. There will be no Jewish state, not even in the smallest part of the land of Israel. This is also the ground upon which al-Jihad stands and most of the extreme terrorist organizations. The fact of the matter is very simple. Israel cannot make peace with people who have within their legal constitution the words, the annihilation of Israel. The fact of the matter is that both Fatah, which is at present the representative of the PLO, is as radical as Hamas. I mean, if you look at the logo of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, you will see that the whole land of Israel is part of the logo. There is no place for the Jewish state in any shape or form. That means that, in fact, Fatah is as radical as the others. The difference is in timing. Fatah believes in a 40-year, 50-year, 70-year time span in which little by little it will chip away at Israel until Israel is demoralized and fades away. This was the strategy of Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of Fatah now, which he proposed and which was adopted by the PLO as its official policy. So, in fact, Hamas, al-Jihad and the other extremist organizations and Fatah itself actually has the same goal of the destruction and annihilation of Israel. It is just a question of timing. The terrorist organizations led by Hamas believe in a one-blow type of destruction of Israel. Get rid of her immediately, as soon as possible. Whereas Fatah believes in a Chinese drip torture, little by little by little, until Israel is no more. The stupidity of this whole thing is clearly seen by the way people talk about the settlements. I was very surprised to hear Nick Clegg say how he called the settlements question vandalism on the part of Israel. But this actually expresses an idea very common amongst many who are viewing the present situation in Israel. We have to say very simply, what do we mean by settlements? I mean, Tel Aviv was a settlement. So was Afula. So was Hadera. So was Netanya. It was a village to begin with, but I mean it was a huge settlement. We can go on to Beersheba. We can talk about a Lut itself. What are they if they're not settlements? So this whole idea begs the question, was it legal? Has it a legal, a legitimate basis, the concept that the land of Israel includes Judea and Samaria? If you look at the League of Nations, it is absolutely clear from the San Remo Conference that Israel had a totally legitimate, legal groundwork for the settlement of these lands. Furthermore, the United Nations, with all its weaknesses, took over the legal agreements that the League of Nations had made concerning the land of Israel. It therefore seems to me that here you have a problem. On the one hand, Israel is doing something which actually has a legal basis to it, and is being challenged by people who call it an occupying force, a bully in the area. I mean, in many ways it is quite ridiculous. I have here just a quote that I think is very interesting. Israel's United Nations ambassador, Ron Prosor, at a United Nations debate on the Middle East and the Palestinian situation said, "From 1948 until 1967, the West Bank was part of Jordan. Gaza was part of Egypt. The Arab world did not lift a finger to create a Palestinian state, and it sought Israel's annihilation where not a single settlement stood anywhere in the West Bank or Gaza." He rebuked Palestinian Authority Chairman Abbas for not mentioning Judaism when he told the United Nations last September, "I come before you today from the Holy Land, the land of Palestine, the land of divine messages, the ascension of the Prophet Muhammad, and the birthplace of Jesus Christ." Amazing that he has never once taken on his lips the word Israel. He has managed to lead the PLO Fatah all these years without once mentioning ever in any place Israel, let alone describing it as a Jewish state. Late in 2011, on the anniversary of the United Nations 1947 recognition of the State of Israel, which now is observed at the United Nations as the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, and in the face of a tidal wave of pro-Palestinian Authority speeches, Prosor declared, "UN Resolution 181 in 1947 mentions the Jewish state no less than 25 times, but for 64 years the Palestinian leaders have not dared to use the term Israel once. I need to say something about the just, will there be any successful outcome to these talks in Amman? I think not. And I remember the word of the Lord as we discover it in Psalm 33 verses 9 and 10. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to naught and makes the strategies of the peoples to be ineffectual. The counsel of the Lord, that shall stand fast forever, and his strategy to every generation. I personally think that this scripture is totally relevant for our present situation. And the Lord has brought every one of these ideas going right back to 1936. He's brought every one of these attempts to somehow divide the land and to destroy any possibility of a Jewish homeland. He's brought them all to naught, and finally brought the Oslo Accords and the Geneva Initiative and I don't know what else also to naught. We need to stand upon this word very strongly, that the Lord will fulfill it now in these fresh talks. Then I want to say something about the Iran syndrome. The IAEA report has finally come out. Interestingly, now that we have a Japanese in charge of the IAEA, we have a much more sharp and original report than the one under the Egyptian El-Baradei, who frankly had a much more sympathetic view of the situation, a much more sympathetic view toward Iran. The report is quite interesting. Let me just quote. The IAEA yesterday confirmed that Iran had begun enriching uranium to as much as 20% at the underground Fordov site near the holy city of Qom, as Iranian leaders had pledged to do last year. The site is monitored by the IAEA inspectors to detect any attempt to enrich uranium to the 90% level necessary for a nuclear bomb. There really is no justification for it, Dennis Ross said of the latest enrichment activities. I don't think there's a whole lot of doubt that they are embarked on a program that can produce, at a certain point, weapons. The International Atomic Energy Agency issued a report last November the 8th detailing nuclear activities it said had no other use than for military purposes, bolstering the United States' case that Iran is seeking the capability to produce nuclear weapons even if it hasn't yet made a decision to do so. Today, in the Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv, there was a report that Iran has finally reached the point where it can produce a nuclear device. This, I think, is incredibly serious. Would the United States and the United Kingdom have both got ships in the Straits of Hormuz. They have said that if Iran seeks to close those straits, they will take action. What kind of action they will take, we are not clear. But that has been their word. Iran's war games in the Gulf of Hormuz has been, I think, reported anyway. It is very interesting that the Iranian news agency has a report in which they say Moscow warned the Western powers to avoid a military threat against Iran, cautioning that Russia would regard any military intervention linked to Iran's nuclear program as a threat to its own security. The escalating conflict around Iran should be contained by common effort, otherwise the promising Arab Spring will grow into a scorching Arab summer. Moscow's departing ambassador to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, warned on Friday. Iran is our close neighbor, just south of the Caucasus. Should anything happen to Iran, should Iran get drawn into any political or military hardships, this will be a direct threat to our national security, Rogozin, who is now Russia's deputy prime minister, said 2 days after the killing of a nuclear scientist in Tehran by a hitman on a motorcycle. Russia feels in some way bound to take some kind of action, we don't know what, should the West take military action. All this adds up to one thing. We now have a serious situation and a crisis in the Middle East. The amazing thing about this whole run-up, this whole process that we have watched over these last 2 years, is that it is the same kind of run-up to World War II. The same dithering, the same stupidity, the same trying to tell us the Nazis were not really so bad. They were really quite good people fighting for their own dignity and for their territory, a German-speaking territory in Europe. And the world believed it. Many people in the world believed. Some Jews even believed it. That's the extraordinary thing. Hitler had said again and again and again, just like Ahmadinejad, that he would wipe out the Jewish people. He called it the final solution. He spoke about it ever since he wrote an essay in 1917 on the subject. And he never departed from the objective he had to destroy the Jewish people. That ended in a Second World War and millions of people dying in the conflict, let alone the at least 6 million Jews that died in the Holocaust. We are watching exactly the same thing. We have America dithering. We have the United Kingdom dithering. They don't think they are dithering. They think they are doing things. But the problem is that the sanctions that they want to put on won't even bite until after the American election. Really take a toll. So we have a situation which is horrifying. Only Churchill spoke up in all those years, again and again, like a prophetic voice. Churchill warned Britain and the other European countries, France, Holland, and so on, that what was happening in Germany would end in a world war and the terrible destruction within Europe. It did. He was described as a drunken warmonger by those who opposed him. They spoke of Chamberlain instead as a great Christian gentleman who was trying to save Christian civilization. In fact, of course, history has now made its verdict, given its verdict. And the verdict is very simple. Churchill was right. Chamberlain was wrong. We are seeing much the same. There are some interesting consequences of what is happening over Iran. Saudi Arabia, I think, would very much like to ally itself with Israel. So would the oil sheikdoms. For the first time ever in history, secretly, they hope that Israel will take out Iran and so remove the threat not only from Israel, but from the oil sheikdoms and Saudi Arabia. Whether this will lead to something more in the years ahead, we don't know. Unfortunately, Amr Musa, who is no friend of Israel, I would go so far as to say he hates us with a continual and bitter hatred, is likely to become the next president of Egypt. At present, he's in the front line of those who are going to be looking to be president. That spells only trouble for Israel. But coming back to this Iran question, President Obama has dithered and continues to dither, doing little things that are biting to a certain extent. But really, it's not decisive. And my feeling is very simple. The reason President Obama is dithering is not just that he has some Muslim background. I think it is far more to do with the election this coming November. He does not want an action in Iran that could go wrong. If America were to suffer great losses or great defeat or even a small defeat, it could have a disastrous effect on his election campaign. Therefore, he would rather put everything off till after the election in November of this year. This matter of Obama dithering has gone so far, that he is trying to inhibit Israel from doing anything. We have had demands that we should explain to the states whether we plan to do anything and what our red lines are. And further than that, he's now sent a General Dempsey to us, it seems, with the one objective of inhibiting Israel further. This is not good. We need to pray over this. Then let me say something about the Arab Spring. Is it a genuine spring, the beginning of a new year, something absolutely new in the Arab world? There's no doubt that many Arabs want real freedom and democracy. But is it genuine and true democracy that is going to come out of all this uprising? What about the Christians in the Middle East countries? Already, large numbers of Copts have sought to get out of Egypt. That is in itself an indication of what is going to happen in Egypt. Far from being a real liberation for all the peoples of Egypt. It is going to be only for Muslims. And the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood actually said, when questioned on the World Service, the BBC, of course we believe in democracy. We believe in Islamic democracy. Well, we all know what Islamic democracy is. It is not at all the same kind of democracy that we are used to. It is an extraordinary phenomenon that we have witnessed in this last year. Dictatorships of 30 to 40 years swept away within weeks. But what will take its place? The real victors of the are the Muslim Brotherhood, and actually no one else. That could mean either the tearing up of the peace treaty with Israel, I'm talking about Egypt now, or the severe curtailing of it in such a manner that it is hardly a peace treaty. This huge convulsion, is it not spiritual? Consider what Paul, the Apostle Paul, says in Ephesians 6. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, against hosts of wicked spirits in the heavenlies. What are these world rulers of darkness? What are these principalities, these powers, these authorities, these princes? We know from Daniel that there was a prince of Persia and the prince of Greece. We actually hear that they had a fight between themselves, and Gabriel had to stop to do something. Is that a fairy story, or is it a window on another world? In other words, that history is only the expression of spiritual powers and forces. I think that is the real answer. This convulsion that we are seeing in the Arab world, I think, is probably due to spiritual forces that we cannot see and cannot hear. It seems to me that they are the real actors in this whole matter. And the outcome is going to be extremely serious for Israel. It may be that the oil sheikhdom, Saudi Arabia, will try to alleviate it, to moderate it. But the fact of the matter, it seems to me, is that we have now a new force, both in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, in Yemen, and in Syria. Whilst King Abdullah II is fully in control of Jordan, it will not actually affect Jordan in the same way. And whilst the king in Morocco is in full charge, it will not affect Morocco in the same way. But it means that Israel will now be surrounded by forces that are violent, that believe firmly in our annihilation, our total destruction, the wiping off of Israel off of the world map, as Ahmadinejad has said many times. What does all this betoken, and how are we to pray? First of all, we should pray for Christian believers in Arab countries. They are going to suffer as they are suffering at present, and I think they will suffer very much more in the days ahead. We need to pray for them, that the Lord will protect them, that they will see miracles amongst them, and that they will be faithful and be able to hold the testimony of Jesus. Secondly, we should pray for the military to be able to evaluate the future and plan for any eventuality. This, I'm now talking about Israel's military, both intelligence and the planning side of it. Pray that they may be able to evaluate the situation that is developing, and that they may be able to plan for any eventuality that will come to pass. And thirdly, we should pray for the preparedness of Israel, that she may be prepared for what lies ahead in this year or the next years. And fourthly, and above all, we should pray for the redemption and salvation of the house of Israel. Now, having said that, there are two other things I should add about this Arab Spring. There is at present a cyber war. And this fellow in Saudi Arabia, who goes under the pseudonym of Ox Umar, has managed to shut down the fire and rescue service in Israel, the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, and El Al, which still hadn't recovered a day or two after he shut them down. He is a hacker. He says he hates Israel, and he has published a whole number of credit cards, and the number of the card and everything else. His idea is to wreck Israel by a cyber war. Israel has said that it will retaliate, and already shut down the Saudi monetary system, and also one of the stock exchanges. So, I mean, is this the beginning of a new kind of venture? Very interesting, to say the least. The front runner, as I've already said, for president of Egypt is Amr Musa. He hates Israel and has done consistently over many years. For many years, he was the general secretary of the Arab League, a somewhat inept organization, as has been so clearly seen in his handling of Syria. His presidency would betoken an anti-Israel Egypt, even if he speaks words outwardly that seem to be more moderate. For one thing, he will seek to make Israel be part of a totally a free nuclear Middle East. He has for years talked about it. And that must be one of his things, to bring about the giving up of Israel's nuclear side. Then I should speak about Israel herself. There is, as we would expect, much tension and stress in Israel as she moves into the new Roman year of 2012. Apart from the possibility of war and the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in neighboring countries, there are other tensions as well. One of those tensions that has finally burst out into the surface is the religious versus secular divide that has for long festered in Israel. It began with a Haredi gentleman spitting on a little girl going to school. Within very short time, it had erupted into demonstrations on both sides and a lot of bitterness as a result of it. And now there have been more demonstrations. The Haredis have even worn Nazi symbols because they say they are being discriminated against and hated by the secular. And the secular are just as bitter as the Haredi. This, at a point when Israel has many other problems, is not welcome. The result is not just a certain amount of bitterness, but tension. It has added to the stress that Israel is going under. Then we have what have been called the tented cities. In both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and elsewhere, these tented cities, as in the States, as in Britain, are a protest against the banks and Israel society, considered by those who have who are demonstrating to be unfair. In fact, Israel's economy is pretty good compared with what is happening elsewhere. Her unemployment figure is at 5%, the lowest in the world. Whether that will continue in 2012 remains to be seen. But it is enviable. There are, however, genuine and real grievances, especially to do with housing and jobs. And then there is a third festering wound. It is to do with the Ethiopian community. There has been some demonstrations on the part of Ethiopian Jews against discrimination. This is a genuine problem. It has added to the tension and stress. There is no doubt that there is some discrimination against Ethiopians. They're often told when they have answered adverts for homes or so on, when they've discovered that they're Ethiopian, it's cancelled. They won't accept any deal. And this is true also. It goes far that one man actually said, I could wish you all dead. I mean, the sad side of this is that the miracle of Ethiopian Jewry coming back and the 7 years that the Sephardi chief rabbi took in researching them when he finally came up with the ruling that they were the remnant of the tribe of Dan. It seems to me very, very sad, and one more problem in our present situation. Israel's military chief of staff has also warned that Israel will have to go into Gaza again in the next few months. And he warns that this will be much bigger than the caste-led war, which caused so much uproar in the world. So all these things are adding up to stress and tension, and it's sad that we have to be reminded, as we have been in one of the newspapers, of the accomplishments of Israel. Israel is a small little nation of 6.5 million Jews in a sea of Muslim populations. And it is incredible what she has accomplished in these few years since 1948. Apart from anything else, the fact that she has 10 Nobel Prize winners is in itself extraordinary for one of the smallest nations in the world. In medicine, in science, and in so much else, Israel has led the way. And then I just need to say about the rainfall. Much rain has and even snow has fallen on the Golan and Hermon, and it has lifted Israel's spirit. The water board, notwithstanding, has warned us it is not enough. Israel has had 8 years of drought conditions, and now there is a deficit in the artesian wells, in the aquifers, and of course, above all, on the Lake of Galilee. We are so thankful for the rain that has come so far, and we ask you to pray that there will be abundant rain in the next month or two. Pray for it, and pray for snow, especially on the mountains of the north. That's more than anything else what will fill up the Lake of Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, to its right level. I'm sorry that to have to report so many of these things that lie at the root of our tension and stress, but you can see that I think Israel, I'm tired of saying on every one of these updates, this is an extremely difficult time to make an update, and sorry that it has to be this and that and the other. But the fact of the matter is, although we say Israel's in crisis almost every time, it really is in crisis this time. And we need your prayer. These updates, I've always described them as not just an update, but an update in the light of God's prophetic word. And I think one of the most glorious promises concerning the time that we have now passed into is found in the prophecy of Zechariah. It begins by these words, "The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel." For many, many years there was no Israel. Of course, the Jewish people, in their scattered condition, exiled all over the world, were called the House of Israel. But this is an incredible word, a burden concerning the burden of the word of the Lord, as if there is something about this word that is heavy, burdensome. It actually uses the word in Hebrew that is used for loading a donkey or a camel, a burden. And this prophecy is in fact glorious and burdensome. And the glorious promise is found in the prophecy in chapter 13, verse 1, "And in that day I, that is the Lord, will open a fountain for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness." I cannot think of a more wonderful promise in the present time of tension and stress, both within domestically and outside, in the Middle East and in the world in general. We have economic and financial stress. We have climatic problems that seem to be far worse than we have experienced in recent years. And we have the possibility of turmoil, conflict, and war. And here comes this prophet speaking some 2,600 years ago, approximately, and he says, "This is the burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel." And then he says, in this extraordinary chapter, when he gives this glorious promise of the salvation and redemption of the Jewish people, he speaks of a certain specific time in which this will take place. He lists them. First of all, it's when Jerusalem comes back from being a backwater, a kind of antique city, not very hygienic, not very modern, and certainly not wanted except in the Crusader period by both the Muslims and the Christians. He says Jerusalem will shoot back, I'm paraphrasing it, his words, will shoot back to the center of the world stage. Suddenly, it will become a city that is fought over, a city that is a focus point of controversy, its future, its status, argued about all the time. When has that been, except for the Crusader period, when the Crusaders took it from the Muslims, and later the Muslims got it back under Salah ad-Din? When has there been a time when Jerusalem has been the focal point of controversy? Yet, in the United Nations, more resolutions have been passed on the status and future of Jerusalem than any other capital city, including Berlin, when it was divided. This makes us realize that this specific prophecy concerning Israel was not for previous years, but is for the time when Jerusalem comes back to the center of the world stage. I think we can say, without fear of contradiction, that Jerusalem is back in that position. Then he says that this city of Jerusalem, the Lord will make it a cup of reeling unto all the peoples round about, a goblet of wine into which God himself has introduced a drug, or even a poison, that renders the person who drinks it wrongly insensible. Now he tells us who those people are. They're the surrounding neighbours. They're not peoples, or all the peoples from the ends of the earth, but they are the surrounding people, the neighbouring peoples. That is precisely what has happened. If Israel had been welcomed, and somehow there had been a kind of wonderful togetherness between the Jewish people and the Arab people, after all, we're cousins, it would have been extraordinary. Can you imagine the reforestation of the Sahara Desert, of the Syrian Desert, of the Saudi Desert? Can you imagine the irrigation schemes that could have been put into place? Can you imagine the diseases like bilharzia in the Nile Delta, which could have been completely eradicated by Israel medical know-how? I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, to think they've been rendered insensible. How have they been rendered insensible over this question of Jerusalem? Its future. It is not even mentioned once by name in the Quran. It is mentioned hundreds and hundreds of times in the Bible. The fact of the matter is that it is to be a time when our neighbours have been rendered insensible. They have again and again sought to destroy us by war. Each time, they have been completely beaten and lost territory, which they now say is occupied. I mean, it's very interesting when you see it like this. Then again, here is the third thing. It says, it's the Lord who does it, by the way. The Lord not only makes it like a cup, a goblet of wine, into which he has secretly introduced a drug or a poison, but he will also make it a stone of stumbling. In other words, so heavy this stone, that if someone tries to move it from its divinely ordained position to another position more politically acceptable, they will come unstuck. They will be ruptured, and their lifting days will be over. That happened with the Ottoman Empire. It happened with the British Empire. It has happened with the Soviet Empire. And now we've got the EU and the United States fiddling with this stone of stumbling. They want to put it into a far more politically acceptable place. Of course, for them, the Bible is antique, irrelevant, dusty old documents that belong to thousands of years ago, with absolutely nothing to say for the 21st century. But here is a prophecy that was given for the 21st century. It is precise and accurate. I fear for the United States, because they are playing a game with Jerusalem. They're seeking to make this city of Jerusalem politically acceptable. After all, the United States doesn't have its embassy in Jerusalem. It is in Tel Aviv. Same with the United Kingdom. It's in Tel Aviv, not Jerusalem. Same with France. Same with Germany. I think it's very, very interesting that this prophecy was given for such a time. Then there's another little phrase that's very interesting. It says, and upon Judah also shall it be, in the siege against you. I've puzzled over that again and again. What does it mean? I think it means very simply this, that this whole problem of the promised land and Jerusalem as its capital is for many Jews a problem. The left wing in Israel is very loud about giving back all four dividing the promised land, all for giving back, even dividing Jerusalem again. In spite of the fact that we withdrew from Lebanon, and what did we get? Hezbollah. Rockets, missiles. We withdrew from Gaza. What did we get? Rockets, missiles. We withdrew from heaven, and what have we got? Trouble and trouble upon trouble. I mean, we haven't learned. So it's interesting, it says, upon Judah, against Judah, is the word, it shall be in the siege against Jerusalem. Well, the siege against Jerusalem has begun, not yet physically, but spiritually it has begun. I find this all very interesting. Then again, we have a third thing. It says, when nations come against, and all the nations shall come against Jerusalem. There was a day when many of the nations, a majority of the nations, were sympathetic towards Israel. That day has basically passed. You now have an anti-Israel feeling. I think basically the EU and the United Kingdom wish that the Balfour Declaration had never been made. They feel it was a mistake. It's landed the world and the Middle East in trouble. And they think really it should be undone, but they won't come out in the open and say it. In the same way, they try to counter the fact that the United Nations legally took over all the commitments of the old League of Nations for the Promised Land and the building up of a Jewish home within it. Now they forget it. No one ever talks about the legal status of Jewish settling of this Promised Land. It's an extremely interesting thing that we're dealing with in this prophecy, because how can we talk about Israel in her present tension and stress without speaking about the Word of God? In the end, it is the Word of God that will be fulfilled, and not the counsel of the nations or the strategies of the peoples. So here we have something very, very interesting. All these things, every one of them, Jerusalem back in the center stage, neighbors rendered insensible, empire superpowers destroyed by this action to do with Jerusalem. Nations against Jerusalem. And then we have a further thing in verse 9. In that day I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Oh, someone says, oh, well, we haven't seen that. Oh, no. Well, I wonder what about the economic distress, the financial instability, and floods, for instance, the floods in Australia that we were spoken of as of biblical proportions on the world service of the BBC. Floods in Thailand, floods in Taiwan, floods in the Philippines, floods in Vietnam. Where else? We have floods in the United States, fires, horrendous fires in the state, tornadoes such as not before, hurricanes of such force as to flatten buildings. What does it all add up? Unless the Lord is seeking to destroy the nations that come against Jerusalem. Now that does, for many evangelical Christians, it's dreadful to say such a thing, because God is no longer a God of judgment. Oh no, 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 no. God is sweet. He's retired somewhere in heaven where he's vegetating in retirement. He's a dear old gentleman and loves everybody. Have these Christians ever read the book of Revelation? This isn't the Old Testament. It's the New Testament. And it has a tremendous amount to say about the judgments of God, which are horrific. That's the only word. Just and horrific. And now, dear folks, if we take this prophecy, we have to say it is obvious that it is specifically for no other time than the present. It is totally relevant for this present time. Then, suddenly, we hear this prophetic promise. In that day, the day when Jerusalem comes back to the center of the world stage, the day when her neighbors are rendered insensible, the day when Judah is partly divided over what to do with the Promised Land and with Jerusalem, the day when the nations are against Jerusalem, the day when the Lord seeks to destroy these nations, in that day I will open a fountain for sin and for uncleanness. This fountain of sin and uncleanness is nothing less than the blood of the Lamb. It is Calvary. Every child of God, Jew or Gentile, has washed themselves in that blood of the Lamb. been born of the Spirit of God, given on the basis of the shed blood of the Lamb. I find this tremendous. Then it's even more specific. In that day, I will pour upon the house of David, that is the establishment, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, that is the Jewish people, standing for the whole of Israel, the spirit of grace and of supplication. This word chen in Hebrew just means what the New Testament also calls in Greek charis, grace, favor. In that day I will pour the spirit of grace and then of supplication, an amazing word, the imploring of mercy, the seeking after the Lord. And then it is explained. It says, and they shall look unto me whom they pierce. Now, I don't know that Zechariah, it is ever recorded of Zechariah that he was pierced. And it seems to me the only person it could possibly be is the Messiah Jesus. It then goes on to say, and they shall mourn for him as for the firstborn, and be in bitterness for him. Then, even more interestingly, it explains Jewish burial rites. This isn't a quick little cremation. You take somebody, put them in an urn or whatever, put them in a box and send them into the fire, bring them out and put them in a little urn, all done within an hour or two. This takes, first of all, 7 days, the Shiva, from the moment a person dies. They're buried straight away, but the Shiva is 7 days of total abnormality. Life is not normal at all, not a single part of it. Then 1 month, abnormality. Going back a little to normality, but abnormality, generally speaking. Then 1 year, in which you're not supposed to sell a house or buy a house, change your residence, or even change your job. Why does it say for these all these verses? I mean, what's the relevance of it? Husbands and wives apart? Shimei, Shimei, Nathan. And so it goes to David, all these different ones, house and family. Unless it means that this will be over a period of time, however long, we don't know, but it will be a period of time when the eyes of the heart will be opened. And when the full meaning of the crucifixion of Jesus and the significance of the work he did dawns upon people, Israel will have a key to its history it never had before, both to its exile and to its return, to the fulfillment of the purpose of God for it. So, dear child of God, you have listened to me in this rather difficult tape, describing to you all the problems we are facing on the wider level, on the Middle East level, on the national level. But here is a promise of God which climaxes this chapter, this prophecy concerning Jerusalem and Israel. This means that you and I, who take this tape, we are called to be intercessors. The supreme calling we have, above all others, is to pray for the birth, the spiritual birth, of the House of Israel. There is redemption and its salvation. Dear folks, there could be no greater calling than to be called into such a work with God, to pray for the salvation of the House of Israel. So it seems to me that in all of this, the Lord has some glorious purpose. It may not at first be apparent, but you know, it is very interesting that the Apostle Paul, who prophesied often, prophesied that he said, and all of Israel shall be saved. Even as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the Deliverer. He shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. Israel, Jacob, Jacob, Israel. Isn't that interesting? Is it a key to something else? Is it a key to our father Jacob, who was in many ways a twister, clever, enormous business acumen, intelligent? He couldn't help but see the profit in everything he came into. Didn't matter who it was that he had any dealings with. He went straight for what was profit. He couldn't help it. And the Lord sent him to the second biggest twister in the Middle East, his uncle Laban. The two of them twisted each other for 21 years. And the end of it was that Jacob was sick of himself. Then he met the Lord. That's when the Lord, the heavenly visitor, wrestled with him. And the heavenly visitor deliberately made himself weak so that Jacob could get him into a wrestling clinch. And when he said, let me go, Jacob said, I will not let you go till you bless me. Then he said, and what is your name? Well, he could have said Abraham's grandson, Isaac's son. He could have said a whole lot of things. He'd get out of that one quickly, but he said, my name is Jacob. And the Lord said, you shall no more be called Jacob, but Israel. I think that's basically where we are at this point in history. Israel is increasingly alone. The nations are against her. Even her great ally, the United States, has questions. It's entirely possible that Israel will be entirely on her own. Just like Jacob, Laban behind him, and in front of him Esau, and no one to turn to. Even the angels came, but they came in two great companies, Machanaim, it says. One for Leah, one for Rachel. No one for Jacob. So when Jacob was alone, then he turned to the Lord, and the Lord met him. So I think it will be with Israel. How it will happen, I don't know. It'll start in some Haredi synagogue, or some yeshiva, or something that we least expect. There, the eyes will be opened, and suddenly Jews will see Jesus for who he really is, the King of Israel. Not only the King of Israel, but the Saviour of Israel, the Redeemer of Israel. Then everything that was past will be put right. And for however long it will be, we don't know. But for however long God will give Israel, she will be the last great witness to the person of Jesus amongst the nations. That seems for some people, I'm sure, unbelievable. That's what the book says. So I find, are we afraid of what's happening in Israel? No, I don't think we should be afraid. I think we should be encouraged. Difficult as it is, the fact is, in the end, it is all to do with the glory of God. Well, I hope that you will pray for us. Pray for the Prime Minister of Israel. I wouldn't be in his shoes for all the tea in China, with all the problems we have on the international level, with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with the European Union, with the Quartet, with I don't know who else. Then problems within the nation that are real problems, that could be the undoing of the social fabric of Israel. Pray for him. Pray for him that he may be resolute, granite-like, as much rock-like as God himself when it comes to these negotiations and so on. That's the only thing we can pray, and pray above all for salvation. Thank you for listening to me.